Deutschlandfunk. Corso. Kunst und Pop.
Adam Green war mit den Moldy Peaches Anfang der Nullerjahre ein Star der New Yorker Anti-Folk-Szene. Seither pendelt er zwischen Chanson und Indie-Rock, singt mit seinem schönen Bariton skurrile bis obszöne Geschichten zu netten Melodien. Und sonst dreht er durchgeknallte Indie-Filme, zeichnet Comics. Und beim Corso-Gespräch zum neuen Album Engine of Paradise kam er auch sehr unterhaltsam. Vom Hölzchen aufs Stöckchen. Wir reden also gleich über Düfte und Drogen und Pappmaché und Billy Joel. Aber erst über die Vorab-Single, da heißt es I'm gonna freeze my love because technology has changed me. Nämlich wie?
A lot of the themes I was thinking about for my last few albums have sort of been humanity being sort of hypnotized by technology and I think it was the year where the iPhone came out, where humans became completely possessed by machines and, you know, it's just like getting infected with some kind of a parasite or something. You know, we're, you know, a species that creates our successors. In this case, our successors are the machines that we make, you know. That was the way I was choosing to look at it in this project.
But it's not like a concept album with this as the overall theme.
Well, you know, it's connected a little bit. See, like, I made this comic book. Yeah. So this is called War in Paradise. And this is a graphic novel that I made that's coming out the same time as the album, which is Engine in Paradise. So they're both companion pieces. And the War in Paradise book, that has to do with a war between humans and like kind of hyper-advanced AI insects that are fighting against the people. And so the first half of the book takes place in the war between the humans and the insects, and the second half is in the afterlife. It gave me a chance to think about ideas about war and ideas about religion and the afterlife and ideas. I mean, there's a lot of information that you can find about the afterlife in bookstores and online. So I was researching it. My record is written at the same time as this graphic novel. So it deals with the same themes. And the way that I usually write is I'll write a long scroll of text. And I don't really know if the line is destined to be inside of a song or if it's going to be a line in one of my books or something. It's all the same pool of writing.
But you seem to, as you said, the technology is like a parasite. When I think of the video you did for Freeze My Love, which has this very colorful, naive papier-mâché thing. It's very analog, if you like, very non-technical.
Yeah, I think that was kind of my point. I find that a lot of the ways that you can reduce the pain and suffering from feeling like your life is being possessed by technology is to engage in community, face-to-face type situations, physical activities with other people, doing things that are real, like, you know, having lunch together, going to people's houses, painting together, drawing together, singing together.
Do you do that, painting together?
Yeah, that's how I did this comic. Me and two friends, we sat around a table and we drew the comic. It was a 150-page comic and we had pencils. We drew the whole comic in pencils and we scanned it. And then we hired some friends to do the coloring. 3 nights a week for 6 months. So it was a lot of community. The whole time, we listened only to Billy Joel. The entire time.
How did you choose him?
We were talking about Billy Joel, and then we were looking at his stuff on Spotify, and we listened to the song called Goodnight Saigon. Mm-hmm. And we were just kind of looking for deep Billy Joel cuts, and then it eventually became listening to all of his live shows and then listening to like every record of his throughout. And it culminated at the end of the album. We saw him play live at Madison Square Garden. At the end of making the comic. It was great. And we knew every word. I mean, it was amazing. By that point, I was like a huge fan. It's like people compare him a lot. You know, they'll be like, oh, he's not like the Beatles or something. You know, like, you know, but it's almost like if a Major League Baseball player wrote the Beatles catalog. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I feel like on an emotional spectrum, he's almost like Babe Ruth. He fills stadiums like the way that Babe Ruth did. But then musically, he's almost like a Nielsen. It's almost like an ability like Velázquez or something, you know, to paint, but then uses that skill to express like something that's kind of almost just emotionally a bit square one. Mm-hmm. He's like amazing, but like other parts of his instrument are like a little bit blunt.
But your album, musically, it's a bit like going back to this beautiful orchestral Scott Walker, Serge Gainsbourg thing.
Yeah. Sometimes you just sit down and you're like, okay, I just want to make something that's like what I like. You know what I mean? And these are just things that I like. Like I love strings and I love crooning, and I love like folk music and those kind of Baroque feeling songs and arrangements, and just something I feel comfortable in. And I think as a kind of an artist, like you want to plant yourself in some kind of soil where you can actually grow. And for me, I'm like, okay, well, this is like terrain where like I feel comfortable and I feel like I know how to make this stuff sing. And I had a great group of players, you know, in this case, like the most refined players like I ever imagined playing with. This guy, Lauren Humphrey, who produced the record, James Richardson, who plays guitar in MGMT, Jesse Katansky, who's this great string arranger who's trained playing like Macedonian and Turkish kind of music, so has kind of like an Eastern influence on his arrangements. And it was cool. Like, I feel like I'm almost making my most elegant sounding record. And it was recorded to tape by Lauren, you know, who has a great studio that he's sort of modeled in a way after the Melody Nelson session. Like, he's tried to acquire as much equipment as he can that was used to record the Serge Gainsbourg album. So he's got his drums to sound that way, and he's learned how to play in this kind of very laid back and groovy style that's kind of very like jazz influenced. And the whole record has a Baroque feeling, like a almost like the musical equivalent of a stained glass or something, you know?
How come that Florence Welch is on there?
Lauren plays drums with Florence. I literally walk in the studio one day. Florence is on the couch, says, "Hey, can I sing on this?" And I was like, "Great, yes."
You know? It's funny because you wouldn't think of it, because she's this exalted, over-the-top, very emotional kind of artist, yeah. Whereas you're more the laconic, you're very different.
Well, you know, I've known Florence for years, and I saw her play most recently in New York City, which was amazing. She's really like a superb live performer, and like, I mean, you know, it was one of the best concerts I've seen. And also, me and her got into the scene called Fraghead, which is it's a scene on the internet. It's kind of like a subculture of people that analyze fragrances and perfumes and stuff. So we all started collecting perfumes around this time, and it's a really interesting hobby. It just the smells are so evocative, you know, and like some of the perfumers make these scents that are almost like snow globes that are supposed to evoke like a place or time. For example, I have a scent that's supposed to smell like the Moroccan desert at night, and it really does a great job of this. It has like a dry desertness to it, very spicy. Or like, you know, for example, there's a fragrance that I have that's supposed to smell like a garden of like mango trees next to the Nile River, and it does a really good job of that as well. You know, so I like these ones that are more like snow globe scents.
It's interesting how you, between music and filming and painting and drawing and now smelling, go for different sensual experiences.
You know, traditionally, like in art, people are supposed to evoke lots of these senses. Like there's a famous Manet painting that is at the Met Museum where I live. It's a portrait of a lady and she's holding a bird and like a piece of fruit and a flower. There's just some different elements in the painting, and there's one for each sense. There's always been this sort of idea that aesthetically, there's supposed to be something for everything that you can feel. And so ideally, as an artist, you know, you're going to try to make a total artwork or something. For me, ideally, I want to draw it. I want to paint, you know, paint it, build it, be in it, act in it, soundtrack it, dress myself in it, feel it, smell it, everything, you know, and say it and write it, you know. I mean, that was my idea with the Aladdin movie that I made, which is probably my most total artwork. And people can watch that, by the way, if they want to, for free. It's on YouTube. Just type Adam Green's Aladdin into YouTube, and you can watch this movie. But so that movie was a completely immersive film where me and you know, this crew, we built 30 papier-mâché rooms. You could be inside these rooms. And the actors, it looks like they're inside of a cartoon because they're inside of fully built, painted rooms. You know, a story about Aladdin, but the lamp is a 3D printer.
And Aladdin is a rock singer.
Yeah, I play Aladdin, so yeah.
And it's all as well has this colorful, naive, childlike imagery. I think part of your art is always also that you keep us guessing how serious you are.
Right.
How much irony is to what you do?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've always been drawn to doing satirical artwork. I mean, you know, like my entryway into it was, you know, listening to Beck or reading books by William S. Burroughs, you know, and things that are funny and satirical, but also like, you know, romantic and explicit. And so that kind of crossroads has appealed to me. I felt kind of comfortable kind of navigating them. So if I have something really tragic, I'm end up oftentimes balancing it with something funny, or if I have something funny, I try to make it have a romantic aspect to it. So I personally find if artwork becomes like completely humorless, I do think something is missing, you know, like I'm trying to make total artwork for the senses, I'm also trying to make total artwork for the soul. Like I want to have all of the different parts that make up me as a person and brain and into a song. So part of it is going to be humor and part of it is going to be romantic and sexual and compassionate or whatever. It's going to have to find its way into this music.
So you learn something about yourself from your art?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a completely introspective process. And I'm my own audience for it. I mean, it's my own version of meditation, you know?
And the world at large, or say whoever's president, how much does that influence your work?
It influences everything. I mean, the whole presidential paradigm, that's like, it's been enormously psychically affecting to everyone. In America, when people say the word he, without any context, they're talking about Donald Trump. So that shows you the level to which the presidential ego has infiltrated the moment. How can that not affect what I'm doing creatively?
Can you pinpoint in what way it influences the music? Because it doesn't crop up as a subject matter.
I try to stay out of it. I mean, honestly, like for me, things like Twitter and things like that used to be fun. Like I remember when that first came out, that was fun. But now I try not to look at it at all. I mean, just basically just try to focus on my family and friends and just like people I really know and, you know, my writing and drawing. And I definitely have taken a step back from engaging with all like the internet stuff.
In order to?
Just in order to have time. And you only have, everyone has the same amount of time. I mean, time is not adjustable. So, you know, so I just prioritize what I'm going to use my time for. And I try to make it to do like artwork and do things, you know, with real people.